Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
With all the talk about Sunday night's presidential debate, it's easy to overlook the fact that not all the candidates running were on stage. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Green Party nominee Jill Stein and Libertarian Gary Johnson were not there. Although Johnson is the first third-party candidate to make the ballot in all 50 states since Harry Brown and Ross Perot of the Libertarian and Reform parties, respectively, did it in 1996. Jill Stein's name will appear on the ballot in 45 states since she's eligible for write-in in three more. By no conceivable calculation could Stein or Johnson win this year. So what do voters hope to accomplish when they select nominees of parties other than the Democratic or Republican ones? New York Times columnist Emma Roller looked into this for her recent essay, Third Party Voters Know What They Want. The article is available online, and we're glad Emma Roller could join us this hour. Emma, welcome back to Think.
Hi.
Hi. Great to have you. What kind of people are most likely to be drawn to third party candidates?
Sure. So a lot of the conventional wisdom about third-party candidacies this year is that it's drawing away young people's support, and young people traditionally vote Democratic in the presidential election. But when you dig down into the data, it becomes clear that, yes, a large faction of third-party voters do tend to be younger, but they also tend to be, you know, supporting Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump at higher levels than every other age demographic. And I think especially so because millennials are the most diverse generation living in America to date.
Some millennials will be casting their first votes this year. Some have been eligible before, but maybe haven't done it. Do we know that people who talk about voting third party actually go to the polls at the same rates that people who might vote for a Republican or Democrat?
Sure. That's a really good question. And while I don't have data to back this up from, you know, talking to many, many third party voters, you know, some of them are still conflicted and are, you know, maybe even biding their time until Election Day itself to figure out how they are going to vote. And, you know, I've seen the traditional coverage of people who are voting for Gary Johnson or Jill Stein has been that they are, you know, these stubborn sort of anomalies in the electorate who are throwing away their vote. And I don't really buy into that because a lot of the third party voters I spoke with are very pragmatic and really talked me through their logic. And for a lot of them, they have really factored in the state that they live in. So it's a lot easier for, say, a Jill Stein voter in Louisiana to justify his vote, or for a, you know, Gary Johnson supporter in Texas to justify her vote, because, you know, it's likely that that will not swing the outcome of the state.
Right. So if you live in a place where, regardless of your vote, one party or the other is likely to win, there's a little more room to make this statement with a third party vote. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And it is about making a statement. And as someone, a guy I talked to named Caleb Hicks said, he's an architect in Louisiana. He's voting for Jill Stein. He said, I'm going to vote my conscience and maybe pull the Democratic National Committee a little farther to the left next time around. So it's that sort of sending a message. Now, there are also people who, you know, are genuinely would love to see Gary Johnson or Jill Stein become president. But a lot of third party voters are of the mindset of wanting to send a message, quote unquote, to the, you know, party establishment.
So if they want to send a message to the elites in the big parties, under what circumstances, Emma, do those elites start paying attention?
Well, that's another really good question. I try not to be cynical on this point, but, you know, if you think back to 2000, it's not as if after Ralph Nader put up a big showing, and people argue that he, you know, it's still sort of up for debate whether he swung the election. People who vote third party like to point out that there were many more registered Democrats in Florida who went over and voted for George W. Bush in Florida than voted for Nader. But the point is that, you know, the party establishment is a little impervious to these sorts of protest votes. And if anything, if you look back to 2000, it only makes the party establishment more irate toward third parties and third party voters. It's not like the Green Party has seen some great ascendancy at the state and local level since Ralph Nader ran in 2000.
Well, let's listen for a minute to what Jill Stein has to say about what the Green Party really stands for and what she stands for.
The American people are dropping out of this rigged political system at record numbers. The current Democratic and Republican candidates have the highest rate of distrust and dislike ever, and the largest proportion ever of the American public, a majority, in fact, is clamoring for something else. The question really is whether the American people will get to hear that they actually have other choices. I'm the only candidate in this race who is not poisoned by corporate money, lobbyists, and super PACs.
So one interesting thing that Jill Stein said there was, you know, whether the American people will get to hear it. And we've heard from some of our listeners who think that we should be covering Stein and Johnson, you know, giving them sort of the same amount of airtime that Clinton and Trump are getting right now. How are third party voters kind of vetting their candidates when they tend to get less media attention realistically than those representing the Republicans or the Democrats?
Sure. And it's worth noting that along with frustration toward political elites and the two parties that have, you know, I think led to some growing popularity among third party candidates, there's a lot of disdain toward the media and, you know, how much relative coverage they get. That said, you know, it's a double-edged sword. More media attention also brings more media scrutiny. And I'm not sure if Gary Johnson or Jill Stein, if they truly got the same amount of media scrutiny that Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton gets on a daily basis, if they, you know, would want that level of scrutiny and digging into their past and, you know, their, you know, past electoral successes and their experiences. But it's certainly a factor. And I think that another compounding factor is that voters more than ever can sort of create their own echo chambers by tailoring their social media feeds. I mean, I know that, you know, the people I'm friends with on Facebook and the people I follow on Twitter are probably, you know, not a representative sample of the whole American populace. And, you know, basically the news that you're getting is now tailored to be information that you already agree with.
How did the Democratic and the Republican parties end up with two top-of-the-ticket candidates who seemed to rub so many voters the wrong way, including, in some cases, voters within their own parties?
Sure. And it is really remarkable. And, you know, it's been said before and it can be said again that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are two of the least liked party nominees in recent history. A lot of the third party voters I talk to acknowledge that they think that Donald Trump is a worse candidate than Hillary Clinton and would represent more of a threat if he did become president. That said, there is still this very deep ingrained feeling among some voters that they are two sides of the same rotten coin. And I think both parties have some soul searching to do, honestly, after this election, maybe the Republican Party a bit more. But, you know, Hillary Clinton and her campaign, I think they really underestimated the appeal that Bernie Sanders would have in the primary. And that's apparent by how much she has sort of tacked to the left over the course of the primary and has, you know, amended her positions on college affordability and health care to some extent. So I think there will be a lot of soul searching after this election.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Andre in Addison. Hi, Andre.
Hello. My question is, when someone makes a vote for a third party candidate, especially in a presidential election, who is listening to that statement being made? And effectively, who cares in a presidential election enough to make a change? Because wouldn't a vote for a third party candidate be more effective when you're voting in those downstream elections that aren't the presidential race?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a great question. as much as third-party voters like to say that they are sending a message, it's unclear who is going to be receiving that message. Now, one really strong argument I have heard is that, you know, if Gary Johnson or Jill Stein receives 5% of the vote this year, that will qualify the Libertarian Party or the Green Party for federal election funding in the next cycle, in 2020. That said, I think there's a fair argument to be made about whether the presidency is really the first resort that you should be going to break in, to have your third party break into American politics. You know, there have been Libertarian and Green candidates at the local and state level who have run and won in some places, but there really hasn't been this sort of groundswell, bottoms up, grassroots success of third party candidates. And so, you know, it's unclear, in the same way it was with Nader and with Ross Perot in 1992, of whether any message will be communicated.
So in the years that we have had essentially the Republican Party versus the Democratic Party in this country, running Congress, that sort of thing, we have not had a third party president take the White House. I'm wondering what might happen in the relationship between a president of any third party and Congress, given that there is, in modern history, just a lot of push and pull between the president and it's been his party in the past, and the other party, and sort of the way that those things play out.
Sure. And in political science, you know, there is this, precept that first past the post systems, presidential systems, what the U.S. has, tend to produce two-party democracies because, you know, the sort of game theory of it makes sense of if you have to win a plurality of the votes, you want to sort of play it safe and get behind a candidate that you think can piece together a coalition, unlike in parliamentary systems where, you know, you can win some seats in the parliament with a minority of the vote. And I think that the balance of powers question is really interesting as sort of a thought experiment. How would a Gary Johnson or a Jill Stein work with our current Republican Congress or, you know, potentially split Congress after November? And there's not really too much of a precedent for that in modern history, though there is a precedent for a third-party candidate running and becoming president, and his name was Abraham Lincoln.
Do you know how third-party voting plays out over a lifetime? Are people who vote for a third party in this election more likely to do so in the future? Presumably there are some, you know, lifelong Libertarians and Green Party voters.
Sure. And I've talked to people from both sides. There are people I've talked to who voted for Ralph Nader in 2000 and are voting for Jill Stein proudly this year and voted for her in 2012 as well. Both her and Johnson ran in 2012. And on the other side, there was this really fascinating Huffington Post story recently talking to people who voted for Ralph Nader in 2000 and really regretted their decision and sort of have paid penance by becoming part of the Democratic Party establishment. So I'm not sure what that sort of turns on, but depending on some, there's that guilt that I think makes you turn toward the establishment. And for others, it's a doubling down of, no, I'm going to continue putting up this protest.
My guest is New York Times columnist Emma Roller. Her recent article, Third Party Voters Know What They Want, is available online. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New York Times columnist Emma Roller. We're talking about her recent article, Third-Party Voters Know What They Want. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. We heard earlier from Jill Stein. Let's listen now to Gary Johnson and what he had to say about his ideas.
Myself, my running mate Bill Weld, look, we were two former Republican governors serving in heavily Democrat states that got reelected by being fiscally conservative, by first and foremost being all about small government. Add to that socially inclusive, being able to make decisions, liberty, freedom. It really is important in our lives. The Constitution of the United States is a document that limits the size and scope of government. The Bill of Rights for the Constitution really is about protecting the minority against the will of the majority. That's the country that we live in.
That was Gary Johnson, Libertarian candidate for president. You know, Emma, I find libertarians so interesting because there are policy positions that they espouse that would really appeal to a lot of fiscally conservative Republicans. There are policy positions they espouse that would really appeal to a lot of socially liberal Democrats. And yet you can't say that they're precisely in the middle of the two parties.
Right. Libertarians are sort of this polyglot party that are really interesting. And I think that there's reason to see a little movement, especially among younger conservatives, younger Republicans, toward a more libertarian mindset. A lot of young Republicans I've talked to say that, you know, they are Republicans for fiscal issues, small government, like you mentioned, lowering taxes, but agree for the most part with the Democratic Party on social issues. Now, one exception to that is abortion for pro-life conservatives. But there are Republicans who support a woman's right to choose. And, you know, especially with how far gay rights and the gay rights movement has come in the past 10 years and how the Republican Party is sort of still grappling with how to address the enormous, you know, change in support for gay rights in this country, I think that makes the Libertarian Party an appealing alternative.
It is interesting that when we imagine, you know, if there were that mythological third party that, you know, Republicans, Democrats and X, we like to think about it maybe falling somewhere between Democrats and Republicans. Do you think a successful third party might form somehow to the right of the GOP or to the left of the Democratic Party?
That is honestly where I think it would come from, because what you're seeing in this election is almost like two sides of the Grand Canyon, or that's how I picture it, with Republicans on one side and Democrats on the other side. And in the center is this huge chasm that cannot be breached. There's so much polarization in this country. And so I think that mushy middle, you have a really hard time building a strong coalition out of that right now because politics has become so polarized. So I think if there were to be a successful third party, it would likely come from, you know, the outer stretches of things instead of from the mushy middle.
Were there people thinking seriously that the Tea Party movement might spin off into something like a, you know, to the right of the Republican Party? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you've seen that a lot of the Tea Party's politics have been completely absorbed into the bloodstream of the Republican Party. I don't think you'd have a Donald Trump Republican nominee this year if not for the groundwork laid by the Tea Party in 2010 and the popularity of Donald Trump as a political figure, starting with the birther movement. So I think in a lot of ways, the Republican Party has totally embraced this, you know, sort of right-wing agenda of nationalism and, you know, almost militant patriotism that Donald Trump really represents, sort of strongman politics. And for that reason, I think that, you know, the Republican Party of today is not really the Republican Party of 50 years ago, although I think some of the groundwork started to be laid 50 years ago, but it's certainly not the party of Abraham Lincoln.
So the most recent Rasmussen four-way national poll, and I think this is as of yesterday, shows Hillary Clinton at 44%, Donald Trump at 39%, Gary Johnson at 7%, Jill Stein at 1%. And of course, that doesn't those national polls don't take into account the way that the electoral votes fall. That is, though, a pretty strong showing for Johnson at 7%. But because, again, of the way the Electoral College works, he's unlikely to win a single electoral vote. Is that discouraging to voters who believe that neither of the two major parties will ever really accurately represent their positions on things?
Sure. And again, yeah, the way that our Electoral College is set up, it's highly unlikely, if not impossible, for Gary Johnson to win a state. I would put Jill Stein's chances of winning a state at statistically 0%, especially because she's not on the ballot in all 50 states, whereas Gary Johnson is. Though there is one state that I will be watching with particular interest in November, and that is Utah. The Mormon population in Utah has traditionally voted very Republican, but it's a very principled Republicanism and a little different from the type of white evangelical Republican voter you'd encounter in the South. And for a lot of what Donald Trump has said and done this election, it has completely turned off a lot of Mormon voters. McKay Coppins of BuzzFeed, who is Mormon, has done a lot of excellent reporting about Mormon Republicans in Utah. And I think that is honestly a state where Gary Johnson could see a win.
He did have some notable missteps, you know, when he was a little bit confused on the question about Aleppo, not understanding right away that the question was a reference to Syria. He failed at first to identify a single foreign leader he admired. He's still, though, polling vastly higher, even nationwide, than he finished in 2012. Is foreign policy, you know, those kinds of mistakes, are they unimportant perhaps to his supporters because they know he functionally can't win? Or is this just a time in our history where we don't, I don't want to say sweat the small stuff, but where we can somehow tolerate these larger mistakes by a candidate?
Right. And I think this election has shown that there is not an insignificant number of voters for whom a lack of experience is almost preferable. Obviously, Donald Trump has no political experience. Gary Johnson was a governor of New Mexico, and his running mate, Bill Weld, was the governor of Massachusetts. But that moment where he failed to recognize what Aleppo was and then failed to name a foreign leader he admired, I've talked to Gary Johnson voters who justify that as good, as, you know, if you don't know the name of a place, you can't invade it, to really oversimplify their argument. But there is this sort of defiance of, it's good that he has this lack of experience. That just shows he's honest. And honesty is one trait associated with Gary Johnson, despite his missteps that his supporters bring up again and again, whereas they see Hillary Clinton as fundamentally dishonest.
The money thing in politics is somewhat circular. Politicians get money from supporters when, especially larger donors, believe they have a shot at winning. And I guess it goes the opposite direction as well. Who would give money to a third party candidate in anything other than a rather trivial amount, maybe not for the giver, but for the campaign, if they didn't think that their candidate could win, their third party candidate?
Right. Well, when you asked that, my mind immediately leapt to Silicon Valley. There are a lot of business leaders in tech, in the tech world, in Silicon Valley, who agree with the Libertarian Party standards because they have this sort of capitalist mindset that aligns with the fiscal conservatism. But again, they are living in Northern California and probably embracing many of the, you know, social liberalisms of that state. So I think there is a natural fit for tech tycoons to underwrite libertarian candidates. I have been interested to watch Peter Thiel's movements and machinations this election. He is He was a founding investor of Facebook and is a very wealthy man in Silicon Valley. He also is a libertarian, though he has endorsed Donald Trump and has, you know, presumably raised money for him and spoke at the RNC. So it will be interesting to see if the Republican Party will be able to draw in some segments of wealthy libertarians.
All right, let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372. We have Wesley calling from Dallas. Hi, Wesley.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment was about earlier when we were discussing the polarization of the voters in America. And I just want to point out that I think that the actual polarization isn't between the two parties, and that that's what's leading to the, I guess, breakdown in our functioning of our government, but that it's actually polarization between the parties and the voters because of the amount of special interest money that gets pumped into both of the Democratic and Republican parties, and that without being able to actually represent the voters' interests, they're just representing the interests of the donors. And that's what's led to the polarization.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting insight. Thanks for your call, Wesley. What do you think, Emma?
That is a really interesting insight, Wesley. And I think that you can definitely see that sort of chasm between the party establishment and their primary voters on both sides, looking at the primary. As I said earlier, Hillary Clinton's campaign could not have anticipated how much of an appeal Bernie Sanders had during the primary, a really historic primary contest for, you know, an independent socialist from Vermont. And on the Republican side, the Republican establishment totally underestimated Trump's appeal, and especially because he holds positions that are really against a lot of the Republican donor class, as you mentioned. He's talked about, you know, he is a lot more liberal on Social Security and welfare and entitlements, for example, whereas Paul Ryan and the rest of the GOP establishment wants to cut those entitlements. He's also, you know, obviously very hardline on immigration, whereas the establishment GOP wanted to get immigration reform passed, and that was part of the 2012 autopsy report that the Republican Party released after Mitt Romney lost. And the biggest one is probably trade. And you've seen, you know, Trump really appealing to the Republican voters by talking about trade deals, talking about NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership as bad for American workers and American manufacturing, whereas historically the Republican Party and the donor class and, you know, big corporations, job creators, as Republican candidates would like to say, you know, supports trade deals and international trade pretty much unequivocally.
It is interesting, you know, you mentioned Bernie Sanders, who, if I understand correctly, changed his party affiliation to register as a Democrat just a few weeks before.
He did, yes.
Right. He registered to run for president of the United States. What does it say about even someone who has been successful as a third party candidate on the state level, the reality of, I don't know that he suddenly had a conversion or he thought, if I really want to do this, I need the support of a major party.
Sure. You mean Bernie Sanders specifically?
Yes.
Yeah, well, Bernie Sanders, obviously, he's caucused with the Democrats in the Senate. So he is, you know, basically a Democrat, although, you know, he identifies himself as an independent. And, you know, I think he read the tea leaves before entering the race and saw how hard it is to run as a third party candidate and decided it would be best for his own viability and also for promoting the platform and the ideas that he wanted to spread to run as a Democrat. And I think that his candidacy has proven that that is true. You can make more change from within the system than from, you know, attacking it from the sidelines to some extent.
An email here from Matt in Dallas who asks, what surprises me is that third party fans and candidates don't focus on reform of the voting system or making the Electoral College more representative of the popular vote. Why is that?
Yeah, that's another good question. And I think it is, you know, the fact that we all tend to tune in to the presidential election every 4 years, it gets so much media attention and so much hype, especially this year where, you know, Donald Trump is a celebrity that everyone knows who he is. And the Clintons are, you know, no matter what you think of them, probably the most famous political couple in America. And I think there's a tendency to check out, not just among third party voters, but all voters, to sort of check out of the process after the presidential race is over. And I couldn't really blame anyone after how long this election has been if anyone wants to check out. But that is a really good point. And there are a lot of obstructions to voting, not just because of how the Electoral College is set up, but, you know, with different state voter laws that you could argue could be disenfranchising to voters by requiring, you know, IDs and, you know, limits to early voting, which the Democratic Party just sued the state of Florida over. So that is a really good question. I think that third party voters, when it comes down to it, they sort of want to send their message and then get out of there. But I'm sure that there are also third party voters who are active in their communities and in politics when it's not an election year.
Emma, do you have a desk like in the New York Times offices? Is that's where you work out of?
I do not. I'm a freelance contractor.
Okay. I was wondering about the climate, you know, when these very surprising things keep breaking. I wonder if you know anything about what happens on the floors of the New York Times.
Sure. Well, just having worked in newsrooms before, whenever news breaks, you'd expect things to get really loud and people just sort of yelling, sort of like in His Girl Friday or some old movie about newspapers. But in my experience, things get really quiet. And that's how you know people are buckling in and saying, oh, my gosh, what is happening now? And a lot of newsrooms use a chat client called Slack now. So maybe when it used to be editors yelling across the newsroom to reporters, now it's editors furiously typing Slack messages to their reporters.
We're speaking this hour with New York Times columnist Emma Roller. Her recent piece, Third Party Voters Know What They Want, is online. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org. You can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Emma Roller of the New York Times. Her recent piece, Third Party Voters Know What They Want, is available online at the New York Times. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Emma, another thing that third party voters said was on their minds was denying unpopular major party candidates a mandate, even if they do win. Does that present real challenges when such candidates win office?
Right. So there's this whole question about not only winning the presidency, but getting a quote unquote mandate, which means, you know, essentially winning by a large majority, and that signaling to both people within your party and in the other party that there is broad popularity for you personally and the ideas that you support. And especially when there is a split government between the White House and Congress, people see it as important for, you know, if Hillary Clinton were to win by a large margin, to try to get Republican leaders to work with her, because, you know, they saw, well, if you won by a landslide, you know, there's good reason to believe that voters in my district agree with you and I should try to work with you on these issues. But third-party voters, for some of them who I talk to, do want to sort of deny that mandate. And again, the voters I talk to normally saw Hillary Clinton as a run-of-the-mill politician, whereas Donald Trump was sort of an unknown. It's hard to know what he would do in the Oval Office. But either way, the fact that they could sort of allow the race to remain really tight would, you know, by their argument, allow, you know, Hillary Clinton to have, you know, not as much of a mandate to work with the other party. And then maybe that would inspire her to listen to the concerns of third party voters.
Hmm. All right, let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. Ralph is on the line in Lindale. Hi, Ralph.
Hi, thank you. I noticed that it seems like for a third party to come about, it's basically going to be impossible until we completely remove the money situation from the candidacies. As long as there's these giant oligarchy type people that are funding these campaigns, and then you've got on the right, you have this whole Rush Limbaugh type people who, that's what you're hearing when you're listening to Donald Trump. They're not going to change anything. I don't think there ever can be a third party until, or a fourth or fifth party until they get all the money out of it.
What do you think, Emma?
Yeah, well, that is certainly something that has significantly changed politics recently since the Citizens United decision of 2010, I think it was. But, you know, you do see all of this dark money pouring into our political system, into so-called super PACs with very little oversight. And that so far has helped, you know, boost both party establishments. And I think, you know, you're probably right that not having campaign finance reform is another hindrance to having a third party, successful third party in the U.S. There are already a lot of institutional blockades, shall we say, to having a successful third party in the U.S. that can survive over the long term. But certainly having this campaign finance system that reinforces the two-party system doesn't help.
What do you know about the way that write-in ballots are counted?
Write-in ballots are, you know, obviously there's been a lot of controversy with write-in ballots before, especially in 2000, and it's not clear how much people are going to write in. I know there's a lot of early voting happening, and early voting has already started. But I think that there will be quite a few people writing in joke candidates. I talked to one young man in North Carolina, which is a swing state. His name is David Page, and he is a student at the University of North Carolina. He told me instead of voting for Trump or Clinton or Gary Johnson or Jill Stein, he's going to be writing in Kanye West's name for president because, quote, that seems a lot more fun than just skipping the presidency altogether or voting for Stein or Johnson, who are both their own types of crazy, end quote. So I think for some people, maybe particularly young voters who are disillusioned with this process, there is an appeal to just say, you know, screw the system and I'm going to write in a random person's name or write in my pet's name for president.
Do a lot of third party voters, are they open to being convinced by one of the two major parties? If there were, you know, a couple of things that changed, would they be willing to to go more traditional?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think on the left, one thing you hear from Jill Stein supporters is their concerns about climate change again and again. And especially with Hillary Clinton's track record on climate change and her past support for fracking, that is a big concern for Green Party voters. Another concern is her vote for the Iraq War and her general hawkishness on foreign policy. That's actually something that both libertarians and Greens don't like about Hillary Clinton, because libertarians are generally for a more non-interventionist foreign policy. And actually, Gary Johnson has seen a lot of support from active duty military members because of that.
Do libertarians and Greens tend to see each other in a pretty positive light?
I think there's sort of a camaraderie there, right? Of we're both trying to fight the system. We might not agree on these issues, but we both agree that we should try to be sort of breaking up this duopoly as they see it.
Hmm. All right, let's go back to the phones. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's talk to Mark in Dallas. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I'm a third-party voter. I will be voting Green come November or whenever I can. And I just have to say that I'm not 100% convinced that Hillary is less threatening to the world, I guess, than Donald Trump. And I predicate that on her hawk-like tendencies that you just mentioned, as well as the fact that she's proud of promoting fracking throughout the world. You know, global warming is an existential threat, I believe, and you know, hence I could never vote libertarian. But I will agree that the chasm is between the voters and the parties. If you poll on the issues, what the populace wants is totally different than what both parties want.
Mark, let me ask you this, and I know that you don't represent all third-party voters or even all Green Party voters. Do you feel like you are voting for Jill Stein or for Jill Stein's party, the Green Party?
More for the party and the platform. Mm-hmm. That would be my position. And, you know, I can't in good conscience pull the lever for either one of the major party candidates. I don't know anybody who could if they actually assessed what they are affirmatively voting for. I mean, you know, Donald is Donald. You don't have to say much. But Hillary has proven to be, you know, murderous in her hawk-like tendencies. And you know, again, I go back to the global warming thing.
All right, Mark, thank you so much for your call. Emma, does Mark's call sort of represent a lot of what you were hearing from the people that you interviewed for your essay?
Yeah, thanks so much, Mark, first of all. And yeah, that is representative of what a lot of other Greens told me. Again, Hillary Clinton's stance on fracking, also her appointment of Ken Salazar to her advisory committee. Ken Salazar was, I believe, a lobbyist for the fracking industry or somehow involved in the fracking industry, and a lot of environmentalists took issue with her bringing him on her team. And also, you know, her foreign policy experience as Secretary of State. Obviously, there's a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters who took issue with that during the primary, and some of them are, you know, the majority of Bernie Sanders supporters will end up voting for Hillary Clinton, I believe. But there has been sort of a split of, you know, am I going to accept this person's policies who I just spent the last 6 months to a year speaking out against, or am I going to vote for third party, or am I just not going to vote?
All right, let's go back to the phones. Sawyer is calling from Denton. Hi, Sawyer.
Howdy. I'm a student with UNT. And our on-campus libertarian organization is about to start tabling today. I wanted to talk about how interconnected the libertarian orgs and the Republican orgs are. I mean, when we have our meetings there the same day, you know, one is about an hour after the other, and we have a lot of overlap in terms of who attends. And we very much have a very strong libertarian streak in the up-and-coming Republicans, and at least at the campus level.
Thanks for your call, Sawyer. Emma, is that something that is maybe about that generation, or does it really suggest that there is beginning to be a shift within the Republican Party?
Sure. Well, that is sort of the interesting question is, are Republican Party leaders going to see the growing appeal of libertarianism to their young party members and start trying to bring them more into the fold there? Again, millennials are the most diverse generation living in America today. We're also by whatever standard have been judged the most tolerant. So I think there's this sort of live and let live philosophy that undergirds a lot of young libertarians' perspectives of, I don't care what you do in the bedroom. I don't care what you do with your own body. That's up to you. But I think government should get out of our lives in general. And, you know, that's their sort of argument. And that is more appealing than the sort of old school republicanism that we like to think of social conservatism in addition to fiscal conservatism.
Is there disagreement within the GOP and the Democratic Party as to how much attention to pay to these third parties?
Well, I've found that there is a lot of condescension from both party establishments toward third-party voters. And, you know, I sort of understand if you're a Republican operative or you're a Democratic operative, your whole job is to try to get people to vote for your party and stay in your party. But I've seen, you know, some commentators even talking about how third-party voters are throwing their votes away. And whether or not that's true, I think that's not really the way to persuade a disaffected young voter or older third-party voter over to your side.
Were you surprised to find how pragmatic potential third-party voters were that you talked to, the ones who say, well, I can do it because my state's going red or blue regardless?
Yeah, I was a little surprised. It's just kind of interesting because there is this logical paradox that I get at in my piece on the New York Times about, you know, the more sure some third-party voters I talked to were that Hillary Clinton would win, the more sort of reassured they were in voting for a third-party candidate. I know the caller earlier said that he didn't see much of a difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and a few third-party voters I talked to said the same thing. But I think the majority of them, especially those voting for the Green Party, do recognize that Donald Trump would impose a lot more, you know, almost authoritarian policies, domestically at least, than a Clinton administration would.
Do you have a sense that either the Democrats or the Republicans are more open than the other party to third-party influence?
To third-party influence. Well, I think that I struggle with whether Bernie Sanders' candidacy should be characterized as, you know, obviously he ran as a Democrat, but in some ways his run was almost like a quasi-third-party run. He was kind of this insurgent candidate. He really broke the mold by not raising money from super PACs, and I think surprised everyone in the Democratic establishment with how far he could get by raising money solely from, you know, a lot of many small dollar donors. I think there's a lot of institutional reticence to pay attention to third parties. I feel bad saying that, but I think there's just such a strong pull toward partisanship in this country that it's hard to see much open-mindedness on either side.
Emma Roller is a columnist for The New York Times. Her recent essay for The Times, Third Party Voters Know What They Want, is available online. Emma, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Eric Bright. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Javier Girabet. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Our Twitter handle is @KERAThink. Email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.